Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle. Joined today by Phil Oakley. How are you doing, Phil?
Very good, thank you, John.
Excellent. Megan Boxall, how are you, Megan?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you.
It's your last podcast, isn't it?
It is.
Oh, it's terrible. Terrible.
Yes, it is. It's very sad.
Yeah, we'll have you back as a guest. Anyway, yeah, so Megan's unfortunately leaving us this week. She's done a great job looking after the podcasts over the last couple of years. This is going to be a good one. There's lots to talk about this
big week.
A good note to sign off on. Mm-hmm. We had the budget, of course. Lots to talk about there, particularly in your favourite sector.
Yeah.
Tech.
Second favourite.
What's your favourite sector?
Pharmaceuticals.
Well, that's the cover feature. Perfect. And you're talking there about China and its healthcare market and how this is presenting a huge opportunity.
And it's just so interesting as well. The Chinese pharmaceuticals market, which people often think as herbal remedies or at least like generic drugs, but it's not. It's an amazing growing market.
Probably a useful time to have a look at it, given that we've obviously got some comparisons with the UK healthcare system, which is having huge amounts of money thrown at it, although not necessarily a budget measure, pre-budget measure. Mm. We're going to talk perhaps a little bit about the high street, because that comes out of the budget as well, and the rate relief some physical retailers are getting there, kind of ties into the whole Amazon tech tax thing as well.
Yep.
And of course, we're going to talk about Howden Joinery, which isn't necessarily high street, but... It sort of is, and it isn't.
It's plugged into the general consumer theme.
Yeah, and we actually had some news on Help to Buy as well, which I know is one of your favourite pieces of government policy, Phil.
I love it.
So we'll bounce off the budget for this podcast. Should we start with the tech tax?
Yeah.
Digital services tax, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about it.
Well, if you are a big tech company and you earn more than £500 million worth of global revenue, you will be taxed on the revenues you make in the UK. So it's a 2% tax on your revenues, which is different to what these companies are being taxed on at the moment, which is their profits.
Which is what companies should be taxed on.
Yeah, it is. But this is the argument. The tax laws in the UK were written in 1965, and they aren't necessarily up to date with the current climate for the current industry climate. And it's all about digital and it's all about technology, and these companies don't make very many profits. Amazon in particular, but it's making a huge amount of money in the UK, and it's not contributing an awful lot to the public purse, even though it's making a lot of money out of UK citizens. So that is where the argument has sort of stemmed from. Europe's trying to implement this kind of tax as well. They're actually suggesting 3%, but it's taking them such a long time to get that through the regulators that the UK has said, right, we're going to do our own tax. 2020, that is how much these companies are going to start paying.
Okay, so it doesn't sound like something that will be especially unpopular with the electorate, and in fact that is probably the theme of the budget.
Well, this is the thing that a lot of people have said. The people who this affects negatively are American companies, and they obviously don't vote here, so it's a perfect policy because it makes all the UK happy, and it's going to annoy the people who it doesn't matter to the Conservative government that the US people are going to be annoyed by this tax.
Well, you say that there has been a reaction from the US.
There has, yeah. It's been quite a strong reaction. I think surprisingly strong.
Yeah, no. So you've had lobbyists basically questioning the validity of the UK going it alone on a policy like this.
Yeah.
And you know, my question around whether it matters or not to the UK government is that actually, you know, these companies do have a presence here. They are big employers. You know, they would argue that they contribute a lot to the economy by the virtue of employing people and the taxes that those employees then pay.
Yeah.
So I mean, it is a worry in the context of Brexit and, the ability of the UK to attract investment.
And yeah, when we need all the friends that we can get, if they're going to be annoying the biggest economy in the world, that's maybe not the most sensible idea.
But then rewind a little bit to actually what this tax potentially means, and the numbers seem quite small.
I know. So 440 million by 2023, that's what the Treasury said. I don't know where they've got that number from, because if you look at the earnings and the revenue from US tech giants, a lot of them don't spit out where they make their money from. But the ones that do, Amazon, for example, it made $11.4 billion worth of revenue in the UK in 2017. Roughly half of that is the kind of revenue that's going to be taxed, the actual digital revenue, its marketplace revenue, which means that based on the 2%, Amazon alone would be contributing $113 million, a quarter of what the government is forecasting. So maybe their forecasts are slightly conservative.
But, I mean, you kind of mentioned that these companies are potentially not, despite these large revenues, they're not making much profit in
the
UK.
Well, Amazon's not.
So what are they doing? I mean, you must have looked at these companies. Is this just literally buying market share before actually then, but then turning the business into something which is profitable?
I think there's an element of that. And I think there's also another side to it where there's a lot of time and resource employed by companies to avoid paying tax. And this can be done by playing off different tax regimes in different countries, deciding where you've got some flexibility, where you book revenue, where you book costs, where you apply tax allowances and that kind of thing.
This I remember that it used to fall, when we used to work in the accountancy industry very briefly, I think this used to fall under the headline transfer pricing.
Yeah, I mean, but it's a very, very complicated subject. I mean, you can get, depending on what type of industry, and you can choose to take, or not choose, but there can be situations that arise where you can exploit a tax allowance in one, book your costs somewhere else, book your revenue somewhere else. And if you were really cynical about it, and I'm not really cynical, but very cynical, people might just say, well, for some companies, how much tax they actually pay on their profits is somewhat optional.
Yeah, in which case, and this takes us back to the structure of this proposed tax, that it's a revenue tax skips all the opportunities.
Yeah, it's harder to manipulate your revenues.
You can't get involved, yeah. Avoidance schemes or whatever it might be.
Yeah, yeah, and Facebook is a good example of a company which hardly paid any tax in the UK last year, despite the fact it's actually made quite a lot of profits here. And one of the reasons for that was because it got a big rebate because it's something to do with staffing. It seems like that's an example of a company that's worked its way round having to pay. And these companies do that in America as well, which was why the corporate tax law, one of the reasons the corporate tax code changed in the US when Donald Trump came into office. These companies make profits, book profits in a different way to the way companies did historically.
Yeah, so I mean, it sounds like the tax code could be simplified to stop companies exploiting these loopholes and actually cross-jurisdictional tax mm-hmm. arrangements, which seem to be, well, they seem to lack any consistency whatsoever.
Well, yeah.
I mean, just going back to the actual investment implications of this, you know, we're interested in these companies for the, you know, the investment potential. Does this really affect that in any way?
It's really hard to tell, but I mean, people are getting jittery about these companies, especially the ones that are particularly expensive. We've had the earnings season for the US companies in the last couple of weeks. We've got Apple tonight, and they weren't fantastic, the numbers from a lot of the companies. Amazon and Alphabet both missed revenue growth expectations. Facebook's numbers were all right, but they are still being overshadowed by all the regulatory things that are going on there. Microsoft was actually the one company which had reported unbelievable numbers again. We've got them on a buy tip at the moment. They've become the second biggest company in the world again. And yeah, it could be a worry for these companies which are being valued so highly. If they don't have a lot of room for slip-ups, and if they are going to be taxed more, and if that does impact their profits, yeah, we probably might see a bit of a correction.
Chris Dillow has written something interesting about growth stocks this week and how much you should pay for them, which in fact you have as well recently, Phil. He says even the best companies, and I think we can include these tech companies.
Oh, absolutely. They're fantastic
in that
companies,
category.
Yeah.
Even the best companies can be overpriced if investors price in even faster growth than they can deliver.
Which is exactly what we talked about in the podcast last week.
And the tax could actually have a meaningful impact on
yeah,
that, especially if it becomes a Europe-wide thing.
Exactly, because it's not just the UK that is suggesting these things. It's Europe, and it's outside of Europe as well, and that's maybe why the US voice is quite loud against this, because there's a lot of people who are saying, right, hold up, a lot going on in amid US companies which we're going to try and clamp down on.
Mm. And in fact, I mean, if you look at the sell-off over the last month, October has been a pretty hideous month.
Yeah.
The tech companies have joined that sell-off quite notably this
Yeah, well,
month.
If you look at Microsoft, which we tipped in the summer, it's down about 4% in that time, and it's been the best performing company in that sector by a long way. So, yeah, they've all had a pretty difficult time.
They have, but they've been bouncing back since yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
As I was trying to write about a sell-off.
Dead cat bounce.
Potentially. lots of contentious, you know, conflicting views on that, some contentious, about whether we have seen the last of the sell-off, but that's something for another conversation. Let's shift from tech and Amazon in particular to the news about High Street and the rate relief, because you could argue that Amazon is responsible for a lot of pain on the High Street.
Yeah, and actually that when Harriet Russell was coming to write this article, we realised that we had a lot of crossover in what we were both writing, because the tech tax is something that has also been implemented to help the High Street, which is really struggling at the moment.
Mm.
And if the tech companies, which are stealing a lot of the High Street's market, are going to start being taxed, that could end up being a good thing for the High Street. Harriet argues that it's not enough, though, to help the High Street.
Yeah, it's a bit of rate relief, but it's quite substantial for some of these companies in terms of their overall cost base. Small High Street retailers,
but it's very small, isn't it?
Yeah, very small.
The turnover, we're talking, what, is it 51,000?
51,000 raceable value on a property.
Okay.
But that's not high.
It's not going to help, you know, these high-profile names that we've talked about week in, week out that are really suffering.
Yeah, so like your Debenhams, there's obviously been some news there in the last couple of weeks.
They had results earlier this week.
They did, they're in the magazine, actually.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a very interesting company. Big store closure program, much bigger than had previously
Huge.
Been.
50 stores, is it?
Over the course of the next 3 to 5 years. And I think they had previously been talking about 10. So this is a huge retrenchment, potentially.
Yeah.
I mean, restaurant groups will fall into the same category. They will not be paying 51,000 or operating out of 51,000 rateable value properties. Someone like the Restaurant Group, for example. Which I know is it? We've spotted their acquisition this week, Wagamamas. Megan, you like it?
I love it
because you like Wagamamas.
I love Wagamamas.
Phil, you hate it because you hate Wagamamas.
No.
And that's how we make our decisions.
Because of the structure of this deal and the price that they're paying.
I dislike it for a number of things. I don't like the price tag. I've got concerns about Wagamama in terms of whether its profits are actually growing as quickly as people think they are. And I think the other thing is that Restaurant Group's taking on a lot of debt here as well. So you're combining, you know, a lot of operational leverage within a business with fixed costs, with financial leverage.
Big rights issue as well to a company.
Big rights issue as well. You know, shareholders are, you know, being asked to fund a large chunk of this and a dividend cut as well. Which to me is, if I was a Restaurant Group shareholder, I would be thinking, well, there's a lot to chew on here.
Yeah, I mean, Megan, this is the so you have had the opportunity this week to write the Taking Stock column, and this was the subject. I do you a disservice when I suggest that the only reason you like this deal is because you like Wagamama. I mean, you have gone through a lot of the pros and cons here in this column. You know, you can see why they're doing this deal, and I think that's the point you make.
Yeah, I can see why they're doing this deal, not just because I do think Wagamama looks like a pretty decent business compared to a lot of its high street restaurant peers. Its growth rate in the last few years has been, I mean, it's far outpaced the market. It's been amazing. Phil argues that growth seems to have stopped, but it has only been 1 year of slow growth.
Not in sales, in profit.
Profit growth.
Yeah.
Come to an end, but it's only been this year, and it's been in a year where they've invested a lot in their store portfolio. They've revamped a lot of their restaurants, and it's currently owned by private equity. Restaurant Group is buying it out of private equity, and it hasn't been sort of overlooked that the investment that the company that currently owns it has made has been decent, and you can see just by, I mean, how popular Wagamama is. It's a really, really popular restaurant chain, and Restaurant Group, at the moment, its high street restaurants are not popular. Frankie and Benny's is, I mean, it's wildly unpopular, which was...
I've never been to a Frankie and Benny's.
I have been to one in particular. There's one in Watford, and I used to always have to go there because I used to play netball right next door to it, and it was grim. And my dad used to sit there waiting for me to play netball in Frankie and Benny's. I feel so bad for him all that time.
That's the price of parenthood. I've never been to a Chiquita's either. I have been to a Wagamama's, so it was years ago. So basically what you're saying, your argument is the bits of the group that we don't like, Restaurant Group know that there's a problem with
them. Exactly.
And this Wagamama's deal is part of a strategy which they're already engaged in with their, what do they call it? It's like a growth division.
Yeah, so they call, yeah, they, I mean, it's just the companies that are actually doing well. They pile them into the growth division.
Mm.
The other bit of that is their pub groups, which they bought a few years ago. And they're doing really well, and they've kind of just left them alone. They are nicely run pubs. A lot of them are in the north of England, but they're opening up a lot more, or they're buying a lot more in the south. And they're growing very well. They're also outpacing the growth in the wider pubs market. They're being opened in pretty strategic locations as well. They're not buying centre of London pubs where there's just so much competition. They're buying them in the outskirts of London and in the countryside, and they're just nicely run. Then Restaurant Group are doing a good job at just leaving that business to run itself well.
And I guess the point with Wagamama's is that this is a profitable business,
yeah.
And will be immediately earnings enhancing.
Mm-hmm. That's what they're saying it will be.
What could go wrong, Phil?
It's not hard to enhance earnings when you've got interest rates at 1 and a bit % or whatever. I think, to be fair on this, I think, you know, I had a look over the figures of Wagamama's, and you know, private equity businesses often get accused of starving businesses of investment, underinvesting them, handing on shabby businesses to the stock market or to a trade buyer. I don't think that's the case at all with this. This business looks very well invested. They've certainly not skimped spending the money on this. And, you know, it looks profitable, cash generative. It looks pretty decent business.
Market didn't think the shares tanked on the day this was announced.
I think what people don't like is they don't like the price tag.
Right.
And, you know, the price tag, based on, they only gave us a figure of EBITDA, unfortunately, which is not a particularly nice figure, particularly for an industry like this. And the actual headline multiple is about over 13 times EBITDA, which is punchy. And what Restaurant Group have to do is then take out costs. They're going to convert some of their own restaurants to Wagamama's and get some revenue benefit from that and profit benefit from that. And that can bring the multiple down to, I think, just over 9 from memory. But that's going to cost money as well.
Well, it also suggests that it's not then a project that they can leave alone. I mean, this sounds like it's integral to the overall profitability of the group.
This is now their growth engine, along with the the one bit I do like about Restaurant Group is the airport concessions business. Just because you just got a load of captive customers who will quite happily just spend money because they're going on holiday and they can make good money out of those kind of businesses.
Is that a big part of their business?
It's a growing part.
It's part of their growth division.
It's part of their growth. So it's packed in with. So they're going to have Wagamama, the pubs, and the concessions as their sort of growth division, and then Frankie and Benny's and Chiquito's is going to be the other side.
Avoid at all cost division,
that kind of thing.
Close it down quietly.
So they've got, you know, big plans to grow this business. I think from the shareholders' point of view, I think rights issues are often misunderstood. Rights issues can be good. I mean, sometimes we complain about the way that companies raise money and that they cut out the shareholder by going for placing. So actually, it's quite nice to see a rights issue which treats all shareholders the same. But I just think Restaurant Group is going to have to work very, very hard to make this deal pay, given the high price it's paid from, given where it started from. And, you know, I always slightly suspicious as well with buying from private equity, because they are very, very good at not leaving a lot on the table for the buyers in a lot of cases.
And dressing assets up for sale as well.
I'm not convinced it's been hugely dressed up. I mean, the like-for-like sales growth is very impressive. But as I was saying to Megan earlier, some of this might be a maturation effect of opening a lot of new restaurants, which are a very good way for retail companies to sort of show that they've got quite strong like-for-like sales, when actually what's happening is that restaurants that they've opened in the last couple of years or so are just getting up to their potential level of business. I think the thing is, even with the rights issue, restaurant group is going to be carrying quite a lot of debt of around 2.5 times EBITDA. And that is still only expected to be 2 times EBITDA at December 2020. So these are businesses that, you know, they do suffer if the economy turns down, their trading profits do suffer. And then you're now loading a load of financial gearing onto the shareholder as well. So I think this deal, the high price, the fact that Wagamama might have peaked in terms of its momentum and the debt, I think it increases. It's quite a risky deal from a shareholder perspective.
Yeah, and actually, you know, one fact you might look at that may suggest that this is a risky deal is the fact that the restaurant sector over the past year or so has been horrible.
Yeah,
I mean, you've had, as you mentioned,
it's oversupplied.
Massively oversupplied. And as you mentioned in the piece, Megan, you've had 12 James Italians close, 17 Gourmet Burger Kitchens, and 100 Prezzos.
Yeah.
And you might think, oh, that's appalling. Yeah, this is a horrible market. But then actually, as you say, oversupply, that capacity is also coming out, and Wagamama's not suffered. So,
and yeah, we have a shift as well in consumer behaviour. You know, you just have to look at, you know, shift towards takeaway food as well. So you've got oversupply, and I just think it's quite a strange thing to throw nearly 600 million quid at a sector like this at this point in time, given all the problems that it has.
Definitely one to watch then.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting. And the analysts are saying that the only way that this deal is going to be beneficial to shareholders is if Wagamama keeps up its current level of performance.
What view do we have on the shares?
They're a buy. They're a buy tip, yeah.
Right, let's have a look at that. You mentioned airport concessions.
Yeah.
I think we wanted to quickly touch upon a non-budget related story, which is related to this, that WH Smith has done a very big acquisition this week in the US.
I like WH Smith's travel business, primarily because it's got a lot of captive customers where there isn't a lot of competition, or there's limited competition, and then they can charge generally higher prices, and it's a lot more profitable than selling stationery and magazines on the high street. And this business has been doing very well for WH Smith. One of the things it's been missing is a presence in the American airport market. And this business, this acquisition this week, addresses that. It's buying a. Also, it's not buying a sort of sandwich retailer. It's buying a.
It's electronics, isn't it?
It's electronics, so earphones, power packs, mobile devices, travel accessories, that kind of thing. And this business has been doing extremely well, and it gives WH Smith a platform. It's a very difficult business for WH Smith to have done from scratch. So getting in with a big established operator ticks a lot of boxes. It increases the quality of the company's profits towards a higher rated, more profitable travel business. So from that point of view, this is a good deal. The but bit is, again, we've got private equity seller and a quite punchy multiple of nearly 10 times EBITDA, because they haven't given us a proper profit figure to look at this. And this is a business that has been owned by a couple of private equity groups in America for 5 years. They've built it up by acquiring other businesses, and now they've flogged it on whilst it's doing very well. I mean, this is a business that is growing like-for-like sales at about 13% so far year to date, and it did 12% like-for-likes last year. So this business is firing on all cylinders.
It's not hugely expensive. I mean, multiples it might be, but in terms of the overall outlay, 155 million quid.
Yeah, nearly $200 million. So it's not going to load WH Smith up with debt. It's very cash generative, so they're going to be able to pay that down. They're going to keep buying back their shares. So it's not leveraging the business for existing shareholders. So it's really risky. Again, it's just an issue of whether they've paid too much. This is not as high a quality in terms of profits as the existing travel business. WH Smith's existing travel business makes EBITDA margins of about 18%. Mm. This is about 10% EBITDA margin.
But they're smart operators, these guys. I mean, they've you know, hung on for dear life as the retail market and, you know, the magazine market has kind of collapsed around them.
Yeah.
And part of that has been just really quite efficient operational management.
Yeah,
they've
taken out unprofitable, low margin sales, cut costs, and they've grown this travel business. I think, you know, apart from the price tag, I think there's a lot to like about this deal.
Yeah,
and I think if they can continue to grow it and they can use it as a platform to win more concessions in airports, I think it's a good deal. But I mean, the market likes it. I mean, the shares are up 15% Tuesday, Wednesday. It's a business that I like. I still think if you look at the, try and back out the valuation of this travel business, it's one of the highest rated retail businesses in the UK if it was listed separately.
Yeah, but that's not saying a great deal. Is it, UK retail
no, but
is
it's,
not...
No, but it's punchy. You know, yeah, okay. It's sort of it would trade at a premium to, say, JD Sports.
JD Sports never been massively expensive.
But actually very impressive in terms of growth and profitability.
We had some other retail results this week that are probably worth a quick mention. Next had some figures out which, on the one hand, digital online looked great.
Yeah.
High Street figures were absolutely shocking.
Yeah.
Absolutely shocking.
And I think the issue for, and the thing is that their profits, despite the very good growth in the online, the decline in the High Street means that profits overall don't grow.
Mm.
But this business still generates a lot of cash, so they're using that cash to buy back shares. And so the earnings per share, cash flow per share of the business still growing.
Okay.
But mainly not through trading, not for trading reasons.
Yeah, we still got to want to buy. It's an interesting car. It's very well run, again.
It's well run. It's not expensively valued.
12 times forward earnings.
Yeah. It's good cash flow.
What else should we talk about? Let's go back to the budget very quickly. Help to Buy extended, much to your pleasure, Phil.
I don't like this. I've been very vocal about it in the past elsewhere about, you know, it's great for the builders, in my opinion. And I'm sure that the house builders are very happy about this.
Funnily enough, we had a question this week from a reader about special dividends.
Yeah.
And he used the example of Barratt Development as a company paying special dividend. His point was that we speak about them separately on our results tables. We don't incorporate the special dividend in the dividend yield that we state, and we shouldn't. We shouldn't combine the two. I think we shouldn't. That was my argument.
No, I agree with that.
The point being that the profits that these companies have been earning and then distributing to shareholders is super normal.
Yeah, these are one-off special.
Yeah.
Dividends.
Well, they've been going on for quite a while, but they're going to stop.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, since the builders have a lot of visibility in that if they're running, you know, a land bank that's sort of 4 or 5 years existing build rate, they know reasonably what they're going to be able to sell a lot of these things for. They can have a good idea about how much profit they're going to make over the next few years. And so that gives them a lot of certainty in terms of how much spare cash they're going to have to give out.
But they do appear to have put a time limit on how far they can see into the future.
I think if you look at what's happening in the house building sector at the moment, with one or two exceptions, even with the big benefit of Help to Buy, it's getting tougher. Selling price inflation is getting harder to achieve, and cost inflation is a big issue. So whether they can expand margins, expand volumes in a big way. Some of them can. I think Bellway looks quite well placed.
Potentially they need to buy more land, though. And that might not be as cheap as it once was.
I think they're still buying land at good prices, okay. Actually.
Which is helping their profitability.
Yeah, I think the uncertainty, obviously, is, you know, what you're going to be able to sell it for, sell the houses on that land in 2 or 3 years' time. If the new build market holds up, supported by Help to Buy, everything will be fine. If it doesn't, then you've got more of a problem. And these builders have been through cycles. They've seen their profits get hammered in a recession. So they're pretty conservative. So it's not surprising to see them rein these special payouts back a bit.
Yeah, definitely a sector to be wary of, I would say.
I think they're good income producers.
But you're losing a lot of capital at the moment.
Yeah. They're paying capital.
Yeah. It's a tricky one. I mean, it wasn't actually announced in the budget, but a lot of money went into the was announced for the NHS earlier this year.
Yeah.
Which was reiterated in Philip Hammond's budget speech that this had essentially already been promised. I mean, we've written features about the NHS. I think you did a feature called Fixing the NHS.
I did, yeah.
It was a good one, actually.
It was really interesting, that one. It wasn't the most popular feature I think we've ever written in terms of political views, but it was an interesting way of looking at it, trying to take a step back from politics and seeing what the private sector could potentially do. Not saying that it has to have an impact, but there are things that are happening in the private sector which could end up helping the NHS, which is costing the government a lot.
Indeed. I mean, I guess one of the idea that you could separate private business from the NHS is kind of weird to me anyway, because a lot of things that the NHS needs to buy, it has to buy from the private sector, and medicine is one of those things.
Yep.
And your cover feature this week, so I mean, let's not get into a big debate about the NHS and how much it should have and how it should be funded and where the private industry should be involved, but there are other healthcare markets in the world which look very attractive to pharmaceutical retailers, mm-hmm. Producers. China being one of them, that's the subject of the cover feature. Talk us through the kind of key points.
Yeah, so the pharmaceutical sector's had a really rough year. It's just tough to be a pharmaceutical, to be a drug developer at the moment, because it's done so well for so long in the US, and the US market's just slowing down because the political angle is getting harder there, and it's not been a great market for them. So a lot of the companies are turning to China, where it's another country where the government is just throwing money at the healthcare sector. And part of the reason for that is because it has to. It has an enormous population whose medical needs have been unmet for a very long time. And because it has such an enormous population, and it's also now an aging population, and in terms of the illnesses that they're getting, it's a lot of traditionally Western illnesses. It's obesity, it's cancer. And that means that there's suddenly this massive number of people who are wealthier than they were and looking to spend some of that money on better medicines than they've historically had access to in China. It's an incredibly attractive market for pharmaceutical companies. And AstraZeneca is the UK company, and it's actually the company that's thrown the most money at it overall in the last few years, and it's done so well out of China. Their growth rates there have been amazing.
It seems to have taken quite a brave approach there, as others have been quite nervous, sort of tentatively approaching this market. AstraZeneca has kind of gone all out, really.
Well, that's what AstraZeneca is doing at the moment. That's why I respect it as a company so much more than I respect GSK. It's taking very bold moves, and yeah, maybe they won't be the right moves, but at least it's really going for what it's doing. It's throwing a lot of money at its R&D platform, and it's throwing a lot of money at China. And it started putting a lot of money in China at a time when the regulation wasn't great. It was a time when like GSK was going through its whole scandal in China. That's what kind of comes to mind when you think about Chinese pharmaceuticals. And AstraZeneca's not worried about that.
It was a bit of a contrarian approach, really, to that market.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I think one of the things you point out is that perhaps when Astra went into the market, things like drug development applications took a very, very long time to go through. There's been a lot of regulatory movement on that, so those times are much reduced. So there's a really excellent table there. Before the regulation changed in 2016, 22 months on average to get a new drug through, which is now down to 6 months, mm-hmm. which is that's phenomenally quick.
Oh, it's amazing. And it's amazing how quickly that change has happened as well. It wasn't that pharmaceutical companies weren't applying for new drug applications in China. It was just that they were getting stuck, and they had this massive backlog of drugs which they'd applied, and they didn't have enough people working. They've upped their staff by about 300% in the Chinese FDA, and they've also got rid of one of the steps which you used to have to redo your trial in China, your drug trial, and you don't have to do that anymore. So the results, if you've done a global study, you can use those results in your application for a Chinese approval.
Yeah.
Which has also obviously shortened the timeline. So it means that all these companies, which have had drugs on the market in the US and in Europe for years, have suddenly been able to just launch them all in China as well, which is why the growth rates have been so high. But now as well, companies are starting to launch their drugs in China before they launch them anywhere else, which is a complete turnaround out of what it used to be. It used to be US first and then everything else sort of as and when. But now China is becoming the first market of approval.
Much, much bigger market, obviously.
It could be eventually. The chief executive of Hutchison China Meditech, there is an English company, but it's being run by English people, but it's obviously based in China. And he's saying that it's inevitable. It's going to be the biggest market because it's got the biggest population, and they are going to end up spending more on drugs than the Americans do eventually.
I mean, it's interesting you mentioned Hutchison China Meditech. I mean, as well as the sort of general desire to have a healthier population, this is part of their industrial strategy well. Trying to develop sort of homegrown drug developers, as well as attracting inward investment. I mean, and Hutchison China is a good example of that.
Yeah, it's the first Chinese-based company to develop a drug in China, take it all the way through to development, and then launch it in China. Ever a cancer drug, and the government is being very helpful to any Chinese company and also any foreign company that's trying to launch drugs in America. They've got rid of a lot of their tariffs. I mean, at a time where they're putting up tariffs for in most other industries, they're being very helpful to the drugs industry. And the VAT that people have to, or hospitals generally have to pay on the drugs, that has come down a load as well. So it's everything about the market is very attractive at the moment, apart from sort of the obvious, I mean, risks of investing in China. They are still there. It is still a risky market, and the risks of drug development as well. They're two risky things, but they're less risky combined, which is really unusual for two such risky markets, which have had such a terrible year. Together, they're proving quite a good investment.
There you go, China potentially the saviour of the global pharmaceutical industry. We haven't even gotten to Howdens, from drugs to kitchens.
Yeah.
Let's talk quickly about Howdens because we're running out of time.
Yeah.
That's the subject of your column this week.
Yeah.
Howdens is a great business. It's a quality business, both in terms of its product and as in terms of its financial stock market performance. But
it's stuck in a bit of a rut. It's finding it quite hard at the moment to grow its profit. It's investing quite heavily in new depots, IT, distribution, and it's also the cost of what it buys in, which is about two-thirds of what it sells, that's going up in price as well. Its margins have been going down a bit, and so the last 18 months, 2 years, it's finding it quite hard to grow its profits. And I've had in this sort of article here, I've had a sort of good look under the bonnet of Howdens, and one of the things that intrigues me a little bit, and something I'm cautious on, is that one of the great attractions of a builder of Howdens is it gets about 8 weeks credit from Howdens, so it can buy its kitchen, do its job for its customer, get paid by its customer before it has to pay Howdens. And there's been a big jump in the amount of credit customers taken on. There's a big step up a few years ago.
So presumably that puts some pressure on Howden's balance sheet. It's got a fund.
Yeah, I mean, Howden is very what they call working capital intensive. So it's a very seasonal business. And actually about now is one of its busiest times of the year. So you get
those kitchen ins before Christmas. I'm there.
That kind of thing.
I'm not going to Howden's. Yeah. But there you go.
So you get big stock build up. And then you get a lot of sales on credit. So that's obviously something that has to be financed by Howdens. And just one of the things I was looking at was actually looking at its trade receivables and looking at the risk that some of these receivables go bad. And it's quite interesting. The actual amount of debtors overdue is going up quite sharply over the last couple of years. Now, that's not gone bad, but I think about a quarter of its trade receivables on its last year-end balance sheet were actually overdue. And the concern that I have, hopefully an unfounded one, but one of the concerns that I do have about this business is because it is reliant on credit, because you've seen such a large growth in credit accounts, that this might be an Achilles heel for Howdens, which is other things being equal, actually is a very, very good business. But I do worry about this credit issue.
Yeah, so definitely something to keep an eye on. I mean, it's not the cheapest. It's not a retailer. What is it? It's building materials.
It's a manufacturer and supplier of kitchens and joinery equipment.
But it's 13 times earnings, forecast earnings for the shares.
Yeah,
that's not the cheapest sort of retail focused business out there.
And you know, there's definitely a housing market theme here.
Yeah,
you know, people get their kitchens done when they feel confident, they feel wealthy from a wealth effect of rising house prices. It's a business that's been brilliantly managed. It's had a good following wind on its back. It's proved that it can manage tough times. I just think that this business has probably peaked and has some risk as well. So what I suppose bottom line is, it's not been good. The share price has been in a bit of a rut. I think it's probably going to stay in a bit of a rut.
Yeah, yeah. Be careful when bargain hunting.
Indeed.
Yeah, I mean, I must admit, I am in the market for a kitchen at the moment. And what I observe about the UK kitchen market is there is a lot of competition out there. There are many, many places you can go and buy a kitchen now.
Yeah, I mean,
it just worries me. It just worries me that, you know, this is kind of all it does.
Yeah, but you've got to be careful who you buy your kitchen from.
Well, I know, there's a lot of research.
And it's
that's what we do on the IC.
The last recession, a lot of kitchen suppliers went bust.
Yeah, they did. They did. I think some of them have come back. Or they
like
were
double glazing companies. Howden's very well financed. You know, this company's got over £200 million net cash. It's not going to go bust.
No. I mean, that's not what I'm suggesting.
No,
I think, you know, pricing might come under pressure because of the competition out there.
There is a lot of competition, yeah.
And that would worry me too. Okay, well, we covered a huge amount of ground there. Thank you very much, Phil. Thank you, Megan. An excellent last podcast.
Very good last
We'll
podcast.
Definitely have you back if you want to come back.
That'd be great.
Excellent. We've got lots more in the magazine this week. We've spoken a bit about China. Mark Robinson has put together a piece about Vietnam, which is potentially moving from frontier to emerging markets or the secondary emerging market status at some point. Lots in the personal finance and fund section, which they will talk about on their podcast tomorrow. Quite a week on the results front, but a ridiculously busy week on the news front.
Yeah, loads of news pages this week.
Absolutely loads. A lot of those were kind of sort of semi-tip update type things.
So many tip updates.
And the most horrific tip updates page I've ever seen.
Oh, it's so bad.
which I guess is partly a factor of the
partly
markets.
It's partly the markets, yeah. I mean, RELX is one of the tip updates on that page and its share price movement is not justified. So that's...
We'll come back to
a shining light.
We'll take this as a
tip update.
It doesn't look good. We've got an interesting piece on the banks in the news section as well. They've had a bit of a tough sell off so far. Loads. And some more on the budget as well. Chris Dillo, some economic thoughts on the budget, which are very interesting, but not for us companies folk to discuss right now. I know you didn't think much of the budget, Phil.
No, but let's not bore people.
thank you, Phil. Thank you, Megan. Thank you all for listening. Curing China, how China's shift to high-tech medicine is changing the global pharmaceutical industry. Look out for it in All Good News Age, including WH Smith. And we'll be back again next week. Thank you very much.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.